I had a conversation just a couple days ago with a musician friend. I asked him how he was, because that's usually a good opener. And he said he was disillusioned. And I thought, that's normal. I should know when I ask an artist that I might get an answer like that. And I shouldn't be disappointed or deterred by his disillusionment. But we just got into the conversation about that. And it was a combination for him of things at work where he cares deeply for the people that he works with and offers them himself and his trust, and they offer him the same. And but it's also part of a large bureaucracy, as it turns out. The system that he's in finds it more difficult to take into account personal matters, and sometimes that trust feels like it gets shattered by distant decisions, and that was hard on him. And person who's grown up in the context of faith, of Christian faith in particular, and very thoughtful, contemplative person about that belief. And also a hard-working young art maker, a musician, and somebody who would love to gain an audience for the art that he makes. And he's worked hard at that for a number of years, and that audience doesn't seem to be coalescing, and that's disillusioning as well. Difficult. And he said, you know, I walk out the door in the morning of my apartment, and I have this sign on the back of the door that says to me, as I go out, it says to me, be a blessing to someone today. Sort of reminds me what I want to do with my life, what I want to do with my day. Problem is, I don't know what that means anymore. I don't know what it means to be a blessing to somebody. So I try, you know, but I... So he was feeling disillusioned about that too. Wasn't sure what be a blessing meant, but still regarded it as much as anything could be as his mission, you know, when he walked out the door in the morning, which I think is pretty awesome. I've alluded to it in what I hoped would be a humorous way. You know, conversations with disillusioned musicians are not very hard to come by. Conversations, I think, with disillusioned people in general, maybe, are not that hard to come by. Conversations with people that want their lives to be a blessing to others, not least of all because they want to live in the way of Jesus, those might be a little rarer. But disillusionment in those conversations is not that unusual either. And there's a part of me that would love to come to you as a community this morning and say, I have the answer. It's in me to want that. I have the way to think about this whole question of what it means to be a blessing to others that just nails down the question and gives it clarity and then provides a concise, systematic response. I think that drive comes from some good places in me, not least of all experiences like we had together as a community last week with Prim and Graham and Sasha and their dedication of her and themselves as a family. The blessing of Prim. Man, I don't know about you guys, but for those of you that were here, that was a rich experience for me. And there's a part of me that walks away from that as a person with unique responsibilities in our community, feeling like I wish everyone could have that experience, you know? Wouldn't that be awesome? Well, I think the desire might be a legitimate one, a good one, but I don't have that kind of clarity around the question about how to be a blessing to everyone. And I don't have a concise sort of three-step plan for pulling it off every time. What I do have access to is an intriguing story that I think provides us in some surprising ways with openings into that. And so that's what I want to engage with. My hope is that this is a story that's going to foster a way of thinking and seeing that points away from despair and toward hope, and in particular toward the kind of hope that we can carry as one human to another. And that's another way of describing blessing, I think. So, stories in Acts chapter 3. I can't remember who I was talking with recently that I probably just as well I don't remember who it was, because they said, Axe, man, I hate Axe. So if you're here, since I can't remember who it was, I can only suggest that I'm about to teach from Axe in a way that you've never heard before. Yeah, there, how's that? All right, anyway, here's the story. For those who love or feel otherwise about the book of Acts. One day, Peter and John were going up to the temple at the time of prayer at 3 in the afternoon. Now a man crippled from birth was being carried to the temple gate called where he was put every day to beg from those going into the temple courts. When he saw Peter and John about to enter, he asked them for money. Peter looked straight at him, as did John. Then Peter said, "Look at us." So the man gave them his attention, expecting to get something from them. Then Peter said, "Silver or gold I do not have, but what I have I give you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, walk." Taking him by the right hand, he helped him up, and instantly the man's feet and ankles became strong. He jumped to his feet and began to walk. Then he went with them into the temple courts, walking and jumping and praising God. And when all the people saw him walking and praising God, they recognized him as the same man who used to sit begging at the temple gate called Beautiful, and they were filled with wonder and amazement at what had happened to him. Every once in the Bible, once in a while the Bible says these dead obvious things that are just really kind of funny. That's amazing. I'm sure it was. I think it's easy to lose sight lots of times in lots of different biblical stories. It's easy to lose sight of how ordinary some of these stories are because they're in this setting that's foreign to us, right? They're set in an ancient time, in a culture that is removed from our cultural everyday experiences. And as a result, it's easy to start to think of them only as extraordinary and as whatever they have to say to us as only the sorts of things that extraordinary people would hear or, never mind, emulate. But what I want to suggest to you is that, in the main, what's happening contextually in this story is ordinary. That Peter and John are doing something ordinary in their lives when this happens. They are doing something that they systematically, ritually, habitually do. They're going to church, if you will. It's also ordinary that they encounter a beggar as part of this ritual. In the culture of the time, as best we can kind of pull that information from the sources we have, and as much as we see an echo of it in our cultures, begging was an occupation. And I don't say that to diminish the impact of killing poverty in that time any more than in this time. But there were people in this culture who, if you were filling in your tax form, that line that says occupation would say beggar. This is what I do. Usually it meant they had no other options. It didn't mean, like when we fill it in with student. You know. They had no other options because in a culture where livelihood was primarily derived from labor, if you couldn't labor, you couldn't make a living, and you had to survive somehow, and so the way you survived was to be a beggar. So it was normal for this person to be a beggar. It was an everyday, ordinary thing. This was their station. And not just their station or class, if you will, in the culture, but the physical place where this person showed up to beg was also a matter of routine. It was ordinary. They were regularly carried to the gate called Beautiful. I'm never quite sure when I read these stories. I mean, I know there is a gate called Beautiful in the architecture of this space, and people would naturally enough beg there, but I can't help but wonder about the authors twining together of what's remembered and what's constructed in the unavoidable irony of the gate being called Beautiful. Anyway, that's speculation, of course. What I remember from my culture, and what I've encountered in my culture, in my time, our time, around some of these same things, is when I worked at a church for many years, it was in downtown Winnipeg here, the street community, who communicate with one another fairly effectively sometimes. It didn't take long for word to get around that there was free coffee and donuts in the morning. And that's a lovely thing when you when you're cold and uncomfortable. And so folks would show up for free coffee and donuts in the morning. And sometimes they stuck around and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes when they stuck around, I wanted to go up to them as a pastor and say, do you understand that you can just have free coffee and a donut? You don't have to sit through this? Like, you get it? Like, it's all right. You don't have to. Not because they didn't want them there, because I thought maybe they were just sitting there because they were paying for their coffee and their donut and suffering, you know? I don't know what the guy at the front's talking about, but the coffee's good. There were sort of a subset of that street community that would come for their coffee and donut, and then they would sort of, they'd disappear for the service. But then when you came out afterwards, they were there, right? And they were waiting outside the church door. And they were panhandling. They were asking people for money. I got to know some of those folks well enough to know that this is a complex subculture, this subculture of the street. There were some of them who were good enough at what they did. And again, I'm not saying this to diminish the reality of suffering, but there is a subset for whom this is the story. They were good enough at what they did that they didn't spend winters in Winnipeg. They saved up enough money that they traveled by air to a warmer climate where they could live on the street for the winter, and then they came back when it got nice. And I started suggesting to them that they needed to stay for the service. And give. I'm kidding. I never did that. Ever. It's a thought, though, hey? I have never, ever been that kind of poor. I've temporarily chosen to live that way on the street for short periods of time. And what it taught me was some very important lessons about myself and also about that community. But that doesn't count compared to living like this. That's a totally different thing, to live with that kind of poverty. And so that's the context for me saying what I'm going to say about those folks that waited outside the church on Sunday morning downtown. I can't help but admire the savvy of it. I can't help but kind of get a little bit of a grin when I walk out the door and see that going on. Because who better to ask for money than somebody that's just been belabored by how important it is to care for others and to give and so on and so forth, right? I mean, some guy and a band and a whole bunch of people just tenderized, you know, 1,000 people. I'm saying this in a congratulatory tone, if I may. But there's some insight behind all of this. Peter and John in this story are ordinary citizens. They're not the uber rich in this narrative. But they're not people who have to beg to live. Now, it's kind of interesting. If we back the truck up in the story a little bit to the end of chapter 2, we would discover that whatever resources they had because they were part of a community that had chosen to live communally. They were part of a community of believers who pooled their resources so everyone in the community would have enough. So they are coming from a culture of enough. That's how they've come to it, but that's where they're coming from. But they're not headed off to church with cash in their pockets. And so when the beggar asks them for money, what happens next in the story, I think, is worth paying attention to. The way the writer of Acts records it is Peter looked straight at him. That'd be the beggar. Peter looked straight at him, as did John. Then Peter said, "Look at us." As a translator, you don't put exclamation marks. The translators don't write like the people who write tweets and texts that are enthusiasts with their exclamation point button. They don't just throw exclamation points after everything. And you ever notice how if you throw exclamation points after everything when you need an exclamation point, what you have to do? You have to use like four. Right? It's like swearing. If you do it all the time, it doesn't mean anything to anybody. You gotta save the F-bomb. If you want to get someone's attention, you know? I grew up in construction, what can I tell you? So when we find an exclamation point in our text, we should, you know, pick our head up and look around. There's something forceful going on here. There's something really significant going on here. I don't know if you've ever had the experience when you encounter people from a culture of poverty or people who are begging or panhandling. Have you ever had the experience where there's a little thing that goes on inside of you where when you're walking down the street and you see it coming, right? You know? You see the person parked wherever they're parked. They're clearly in that kind of a setting and in that kind of a stance, whatever that is in that milieu. And there's this little thing that happens inside of you where you have to kind of decide what you're going to do, right? And maybe we don't do it consciously all the time. One of the things the people that I lived with on the street for a while taught me was to do it consciously all the time. I can't not have this process anymore. It's no credit to me. But the thing happens inside of me where I have to choose. I have to choose whether I'm going to keep my head up or whether I'm going to put my head down. I have to choose whether I'm going to respond or act as though there's a human that's very proximate to me that is not there. I have to decide what that engagement's going to look like, if it's going to look like anything. A whole bunch of decisions, a split second, just walking down the street. What I'm actually wrestling with is what it means to walk out the door and be a blessing to someone. It's actually what I'm fiddling with. It's big. It's not little. And so, when Peter and John say to the beggar, who's a fixture, and like the beautiful gate, it's part of the architecture, you know? It's just there every day. Furnishing of the culture. And the noise that he makes, you know that noise asking for money? It's white noise. Right? Every time I walk past this corner. They have to decide what they're going to do with that. And what they decide to do with that is to say, first of all, to look straight at the person. And then to say to that person, who in the culture of begging, which is also often a culture of shame, say to the person, look at us. Look right at us. That is so disconcerting sometimes. I had the privilege yesterday of officiating at Nick and Nadia's wedding, Nick Mullen's wedding. And so, you know, when you're officiating at a wedding, you get to do the meditation, right? Which, if you're a preacher, is kind of fun. Because nothing like preaching at a wedding to challenge somebody who preaches. Because what hasn't been said at a wedding? Thank God they didn't ask me to speak on the love chapter, you know. That one's been so done. It's just like, this chapter's really about hate. I mean, what do you say about that? Because you might actually, you know, join you for 10 minutes of reflection. Anyway. So I kind of had prepared what I prepared. My family was there, Davis and Kareen and the kids. And I just started in, and Davis leaned over to Kareen, and he said, I don't think he's going to make it very far. I love my family. So, you know, before he gets emotional, before he breaks down, you know, so sure. Thanks, you guys. So it's their way of cheering for me. And I made it. He said to me later, you made it way further than I thought you would. It's like, what, you guys got a betting pool?
Yeah.
You
know?
Anyway, here's the reason I'm telling you this whole story is because of this look at me part. Normally, if I'm doing a wedding and I'm doing that bit at a wedding, the couple's like, ah, like they're off in some other happy, euphoric, fuzzy, soft focused space. I can say anything. They have no idea. They're not paying attention to me at all. So I actually ended up talking to the community half the time. Because they got nothing else to do, right? Let's sit there. So I might as well talk to them. Okay, so I start into this meditation, and these two guys turn, and they both look me right in the eye. They're this far away. They turn and look me right in the eye, and they hardly blink for the whole meditation. I wasn't crying because what I was talking about meant so much to me. I was so disconcerted, I didn't know what else to do. Anyway, it's not quite the case, but it was really kind of unnerving. It was lovely and really kind, you know? But it was just like, holy cow, you guys are really I would have prepared this more carefully if I knew it was going to listen. Anyway,
when we look somebody in the eye and we give them our attention like that, there's something that happens that is very, very hard to articulate, but it is not unsubstantial. It's real. It's really hard to define and really hard to kind of do as an obligation. We can look somebody in the eye as a technique, right? And there's a place for that. But that's different than when we say to someone, I want to see you and I want you to see me. I want you to look in through these portals and I want to look in through those in you and I want to see what's really going on in there. And I'm going to let you see what's really going on in here. Look at us. Well, how ordinary is that? Looking at somebody? Don't we do this all the time?
If I want to walk out the door of my house in the morning with this mission of carrying blessing, favor was the word that we used at Prim's Blessing last week, into the world, probably the first, most straightforward thing I can do to do that is pick my head up and look at the other humans in the world. And whether that means I'm looking across some sort of a cultural barrier or a socioeconomic barrier or a class barrier or whatever barrier, it might make it a bit more challenging, but the action is the same. The action is just this fundamental, essential human action. Look at you. I'm looking. I want to see you, and I want to be seen by you. Not on the outside, but on the inside. One of the things that this assails, you guys, is that it assails a way of living that can treat people, real people, as categories of problems. This is why when you train a soldier, you train them to think about the person opposite them in the conflict as the enemy, the insurgent, the rebel, the pick a category. Not the human. It's really, really hard to carry with us the reality that people are not categories but unique expressions of the creative overflow of God. I think to do that in any routine way means I have to look at people. And I have to invite them to look at me. I think this is where something like blessing starts. It's interesting, this next bit of the story is, I think, where the story often kind of gets thrown out for people who are looking for ordinary ways to bless other people, because something happens here that kind of removes this story for lots of us in our imagination from the realm of everyday life, and it takes it into the realm of sort of super faith or some kind of triumphalism or something like that. So we just read the story, we know what happens, right? Peter and John are about to heal this guy. They're about to make him stand up and walk. It's like they're about to hand him, in socioeconomic terms, it's like they're about to hand him the proceeds of a lottery win, right? They're about to change his entire reality. If this was a geographic miracle, they're about to move him from the land of the damned to the home of the free and the brave, where anything's possible. And so, when we come to this part of the story, it's easy for us to kind of roar right past the everyday engagement that actually happens here. Because we just kind of gloss it. We just get kind of all starry-eyed about the miracle, or what we think is the miracle. And we miss this bit. There's an expectation gap in this story, right? The beggar's asking for money. That makes sense. Peter and John don't have any money. Verse 6, Peter says, "Silver and gold I do not have, but what I have, I give you." This is the bit that we miss because of what Peter does.
on the heels of that. We miss the ordinary, everyday significance of what I have, I give you. We lose sight of it because of the spectacular nature of what Peter gives to this particular beggar. But what if healing in this story is both sort of a spectacular example of what I'm going to call the residual power of the presence of Jesus? It's almost like this echo of the presence of Jesus that's kind of going on all the way through Acts. And it's particular in certain ways, and I'm not making a theological statement about the gifts that are in force or aren't in force. God help us. We need to have that debate. Anyway, I'm being dismissive about an enormous set of questions, I know. But allow me to just do that for the moment. If you really want to debate that, let's talk later. But there's something unique that's happening in Acts, regardless of our theological understanding of post-Acts, that just resides in this part of the story in ways that it doesn't reside anywhere else, in this moment in history. But what if the healing that happens in this story is both kind of a spectacular example of that residual power of Jesus in that moment in history, and it's a window into the partial nature of healing in life in general? See, here's what's missing. Here's what happens between the lines of the dialogue. Peter heals the ankles and legs of the lame beggar. He's begging because he's lame. Now he's no longer lame. He walks and jumps into the temple praising God. We can't help but be happy about that. That's a lovely thing. And then he walks and jumps out of the story. Here's the question. These are the kind of questions Scripture leaves for us, people. What did he do on Monday? Anybody who's paying attention to the aid conversation in this planet knows that just handing somebody the solution to poverty in dollars and cents terms, socioeconomic terms, actually isn't necessarily always a good thing. That's easy for the rich white guy to say, I know. But this is what the research says. That there's something about dignity and empowerment and choice and engagement and all those other things that are about the core of what it means to be a fully alive human being that can get not just glossed, but actually killed in that kind of an aid equation. So it's missing from the story entirely and is left to us to wrestle with and imagine, is what does the healed beggar do with his healing? Guess who isn't in charge of what the beggar does with his healing? Peter and John. Who gave him the gift? Peter and John. Do you see where this is going? They give this person a blessing, and it does not come with any kind of a guarantee that it answers the core problem. Does it address a desperate, easily seen need? Absolutely it does. Beyond that, you can hear the squeak as it goes out of their grasp, you know, like it's just gone until the rest of life. The place where we choose and where we live. When we bless people, when we carry the favor of God, which we arrive with and which they arrive with and which we all arrive with, but which we don't all feel like we're aware of or can actually acknowledge or live out of. When we try to carry the favor of God into the world, however we do that, even in as simple a way as looking someone in the eye and inviting them to look us in the eye and speaking something of hope or dignity into that story, it does not come with any kind of a guarantee about what happens next. Having tried to make this a discipline in my life, in my engagement with the people who live on the street, I won't belabor you with the details of the stories, but there have been times where it was absolutely lovely, where there was this interaction and this exchange and all of that, and there were other times where when we engaged as human beings and I didn't hand over the cash, I just got a big skew, and that was the whole exchange, right? Because it wasn't what the person was asking for or expecting, and I didn't meet the expectation, and without that, there was nothing good that was going to happen there. Didn't matter how much I said, look at me, I'm looking at you, I see you as a human being. Fuck you. What I want is a cup of coffee, not some engagement with a, you know, bleeding heart liberal, rich white guy. Thank you. It doesn't come with any guarantees, right?
And it didn't then either.
So we just need to keep a grip on this. And the reason we need to keep a grip on it is because if we lose our grip on it, we start to behave like we shouldn't engage. We shouldn't carry favor into the world because, man, you know, we can't really heal anything. Like, the whole thing's beyond our grasp. The problem's too big. What difference does it make if I engage with somebody or if I don't engage with somebody? The same difference it would make, people, if we could walk up to somebody who couldn't walk and say, stand up and walk, and they did. It's partial. In this story and in our story, it's always partial. It's a limited engagement with a limitless challenge. We are the purveyors, conveyors, livers out of something way bigger than we are. We are participating in something way beyond us when we do these things. And so when we do them, we don't do them because of what we know is going to come back. We do them as an act of faith. We do them as participation in something that we understand and believe to be bigger than us and better than us in the end. We don't do it because what we know is going to come back. It's not the way it works. And it's not the way it worked in this story. The reality of the no guarantees part of carrying blessing into the world is not an adequate excuse to back away from engagement personally, locally, globally, whatever level of engagement. It's possible to just plain not act because our actions don't come with any kind of a guarantee. At the heart of these guys giving what they do have to give, which doesn't come with any guarantees, right in the heart of that set of actions, there's this little phrase at the beginning of verse 7. Kind of puts the verbs into the thing. Peter, in front of the beggar, says, taking him by the right hand, he helped him up. Remember that he didn't help him up knowing what he would do was having been helped up. He just helped him up. Was having a lovely chat with somebody from this community in the park, a little park off Osborne, a week and a half or so ago. Beautiful day, and so we were sitting outside talking together, and we were kind of wrapping up our time and heading back toward. I was heading back toward my car and walked past this guy in the park, and he asked me for some money. And he was obviously on hard times. And I said, what do you... I looked at him, because I made that choice that time. I said, what do you want the money for? He said, well, I'd like to buy a sandwich. He said, I'm trying to get together enough money to buy a sandwich. I said, because, I mean, you know, right. You don't have to be a deep-seated cynic. To have a little voice in your head going, has this sandwich been in a blender? Anyway, you know, that whole stereotype. So I said to him, I said, how much you got? Sorry, now I'm asking him for money, right? How much you got? He said, well, I've got things in his pocket. He said, I got $3. How much do you think you need for a sandwich? Well, I need a couple more bucks. I said, how about we go, because Subway's right over there. Would that be a good sandwich? Yeah, it'd be great. Well, how about we go over there and you put in your $3 and I'll pay the rest and we'll get the sandwich. He said, that'd be awesome. I'm like, all right. Now we're getting somewhere. So we head to the Subway and he was just a really gracious guy. We had this lovely brief conversation. I had to go home and, ironically, I suppose, make supper for my kids. But anyway, so that's playing in my head, you know. They're not going to go hungry tonight. So along the way, we kind of chat a little bit. His name's Jerry, and I said, I expressed my regret about not having the time to sit and hear the whole story. He said, well, it's not a very happy one. And I acknowledged it, that, you know, I believed that, and there was some ache around that, and I was sorry that I didn't have time to hear the details, but I hope at least having something in his stomach would help with the next bit of the journey, you know. So we went into Subway, and he just kept asking me, can I have that?
would be okay if I, because that's a little bit more than this. Is that sandwich okay? So it's like, it's a difference between $2 and $3 for me. You know, this is not going to, I'm still going home to make supper for my kids. It's going to be fine. So we got him a nice sandwich, not just the cheapest one we could squeeze out of Subway. And I went home. I have no idea what happened next, but when I left, Jerry was committed to having a sandwich that had not been in a blender, and I was pleased about that. What do we have to put down? What do we have to let go of to choose to engage with people, to convey blessing, knowing that it's not ultimate, but we're still, like Peter and John in the story, we're choosing to connect to somebody and give them what we have. Because there's got to be, like, why wouldn't we do that? Why wouldn't I do that? What do I have to get past so I don't look right past someone that's in need? What do I have to do so I choose to see them and invite them to see me and engage with them and give them what I have rather than walking away because I don't think I have what they need, I don't have enough of what they need. Like, what is that? I talked a few weeks ago about this fiction family song that I like that has this hook in it, "Put Your God Badge Down and Love Someone." And that got me thinking this when I was preparing this about what I need to put down, what I need to set aside, what is it that gets in the way of me, you know, engaging with, conveying, blessing, carrying favor into the world. I'm not going to make a list for us as a community. We all have our own things that are on our list, but I think that's really worth some reflection, some personal rumination, you know? What's my God badge? What is it that is maybe has a uniquely religious or self-righteous shape to it that I need to put down because it gets in the way of actually loving someone? I believe that we are formed by what we engage with and that we are formed by who we engage with. And that if we want to release whatever goodness of God we carry with us into the world, whatever shape that might have, we need to see others, we need to invite them to see us. We need to be willing to give people what we have, not what we don't have, knowing that that whole action is not one that comes with some kind of guarantees. And we need to actually physically do something. We need to actually engage. That's Peter's reaching out that right hand and helping the guy out. There's an embodied something that needs to give shape to this. And when good things come of carrying blessing into the world like that, and sometimes they visibly, tangibly will, then if we keep going in the story, what we would see is that what Peter and John do with this good thing, when people come to them and go, "You are awesome," is they just say, "Well, you're missing the point. The point is that what we were carrying that made something good happen here was the power of God as known in Jesus." And that's where the credit should go. And so we get to do that when good things come of carrying blessing into the world. And that does us more good, I think, than our imaginations are usually trained to entertain as well.